Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Psychology of Work, Why People Do What They Do, a podcast exploring the science and stories behind high-cohesion, high-performing teams. My name is Dr. Bobbi Wegner. I'm a lecturer at Harvard in organizational psychology and the founder of Groups. In each episode, we dive into the minds of industry experts to uncover what drives team and individual dynamics, tackle real-world challenges together, and share actionable insights to help teams feel and function their best. Thanks so much for joining, and let's get started. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited to be back. Welcome to The Psychology of Work. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by Larry Hartman, who's the CEO of ZRG Partners. It's one of the fastest growing global executive search and talent advisory firms. ZRG works with organizations around the world on leadership search, consulting, culture, and talent strategy, and is really known for bringing a more data-driven approach to understanding leadership and organizational performance. Before ZRG, Larry co-founded Rockford Industries, helping grow it into a publicly traded company before its acquisition, where he later served as an executive leader. Across his career, Larry has focused deeply on leadership, scaling organizations, talent, and what actually drives high-performing teams and cultures. So I'm just so excited to have you here today, Larry, and just want to learn more about you. So tell me about like who you are, what's your story? You know, when we first met, I was like, this guy's done everything. I feel like you've done all the things. And then now you're leading this incredible firm. So who are you? What's ZRG?
Thanks, Bobbi. I appreciate talking with you about this and happy to share a little bit of my journey because I think it is a little bit of a unique journey. I mean, I think my story is as an entrepreneur who started two businesses from scratch that have actually worked out. It usually doesn't work out that way.
Hit rate's high.
Yeah, most businesses fail. I don't know what the odds are these days. But, so my quick story is I started my first business right out of college, not knowing what I was doing with a couple partners in the financial service space. And, one of those stories of with 6 months without making a dime, struggle, finally figured it out. But we had this dream to take the company public. So it was a really cool story. Like 10 years in, we were able to do a public offering on the NASDAQ. I was in my 30s. It was so exciting to see the ticker come across. And we traded for 3 years as a public company and then had that dream of selling it. We sold it to American Express very successfully. And then I saw what big corporate America was, which was kind of interesting. And that was my first chapter. And then chapter two, somewhat similar but different, started ZRG 20 plus years ago from a startup. And that business scaled differently. We're today 700 employees. We're over $300 million in revenues. We're the seventh largest global executive recruiting firm in the world now, second round of private equity. And it's been this long journey of growth. But the similarity is just, I think I've been able to fortunately scale things from nothing to something twice. So that's probably the thing of my business story.
I mean, that's incredible and just so admirable as a founder, being like, wow, how do you do that? And that's awesome. And, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this because I didn't think about it beforehand, but like, what are the parallels? Because those are two different kinds of companies, right? But what parallels live between those? Or is it like, you're just good at that early stage or all of the above,
Yeah, I wish it was probably more planful, but so they are both business services. So our first business was we were lending money to doctors and hospitals to finance capital equipment. And we used other people's money to bridge the gap. And it was a service business and did that for a number of years. But the reality was after I sold my business to American Express, I had a non-compete for a bunch of years to do something in that space. And so started ZRG as a service business doing consulting advisory work to the niche that I knew in financial services. So there was that, carryover. I wanted to do something a little different. I think a lot of times entrepreneurs sell a business and do the same business two and three times over successfully. And, but I just felt like it'd be interesting to learn a new business, do something differently. And talent was always a key part of the early success we had in my first business. So that was probably the attraction to thinking about building a business that was around finding and retaining and recruiting the best people.
So it sounds like kind of being in a similar niche a little bit, but a different type of business. So you knew the people that was like the consistent, but then actually offered something else in terms of the actual product.
Yeah. And I think the things in both businesses, I start a business, I'm very hands-on figuring out how to get clients, serve clients, do the work. And that was in the first business. Second business, I worked with my own clients. I figured out how to support them, Then I figured out how to scale it. You know, today we have 200 plus business development people serving clients, but I had to understand it myself first and figure out, okay, what does a client need? How do we support them? What's our unique value proposition that allows us to win? So I think that, you know, kind of being willing to be hands-on, start from scratch, you know, maybe it's not the smartest way to build a business, but it's how I've done it twice. It's just what I know.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like the consistency too. Like you're willing to get your hands in there and actually figure it out before you grow. And then I think a lot of people don't like that, you know, like do not like putting structure around something that doesn't exist. So you either have to be really into it, at least in like the founder world I hang out with. It's like founders, you know, I say this lovingly because I'm one of these people, but it's like, you know, a weird little group of people who like to just solve a problem and be comfortable in not knowing what they're doing until they do.
Yeah.
You know, which like most people hate that, but it sounds like you, there's something about that, that you like.
Well, no. And I think I'll tell, you know, as I talk to students, sometimes I'm doing talks at universities, it's, you know, being an entrepreneur and building a business, it's hard work. I show up every day with a lunch pail.
Yeah.
I mean, do it 20 plus years and you grind away and one foot after another year after year, and it creates, you know, good outcomes, you know, and I think that we live in this world where people want instant gratification and maybe things to happen quicker. And it can happen. I mean, in the days of AI and technology, you know, there's people doing amazing things very quickly, but there's also boring entrepreneurs like me that take existing businesses, find a twist, scale it, and build it that way as well. So there's not just one way to do it. No.
Yeah. Can you see your, like, I just, when I look at myself and I look back, I'm like, sometimes I'm like, oh, cool, we're doing these things, or I met with this person or whatever it is. And I don't really have the presence to almost like stop and look back at times, you know? And then when I do that, I'm like, oh, wow, we've actually built something, you know, over the past few years. And my COO is really good at reminding me to do that, because sometimes I'm like, all right, what's next? Great win, onward, you know? But when I actually pause and I reflect, I'm like, oh, this is like really fun and, you know, or something to be proud of and, you know, all that. But I wonder what it's like for you, because you've just done this multiple times and you've just done this at like a much bigger scale.
Well, it's tricky. What you're talking about, a lot of entrepreneurs are visionaries and they love what's next, right? But they don't want to tend to the grinding away of what it takes to build clients, revenues, and cash flow, right? So, you know, I think that's probably, I've got these two sides of my brain that can operate in both spheres, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a vision, I have a plan, and I can spend 10, 20% of my time thinking, dreaming there, but then show up, get things done, and, you know, do the hard work that gets you there. And sometimes entrepreneurs can have both those gears. Other times you got to build a team that has that, right? So, you know, again, I, and my businesses, I mean, my first business, I had two partners. It was three of us. My second business started with two of us. My bought out my partner a decade ago. But I've always felt, you know, starting up, it's hard to do it alone. You know, it's lonely. I mean, it, you know, so doing it with a group that might have, you know, kind of complementary skills is a good way to address like what you're saying. Like you may have very good, strong skills in a certain area. Well, if you have a partner that has the exact same skills, that's probably a miss. Right.
Yeah.
You've got to have kind of complementary and then have some crossing skills that, you know, kind of together you both share. And that's, you know, the essence of, I think, great teams. But, you know, in entrepreneurial businesses, I think it's even more important to get it right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because if you miss, there's no cushion, you know? So it's like, you better kind of, you know, at least with us, like my COO is like everything I'm not. She's like all ops, German military architect, you know, all the things. And I'm more like, you know, kind of people, product, thinking forward, all that stuff. Anyway, we can psychoanalyze our company another time. I'm curious about you and your company. So tell us about ZRG and what are you doing? And, you know, it's, what do you guys do?
So we're in an interesting space. We're in the executive recruiting space. So we built a business that does senior level recruiting for executives. It's expanded down to interim leadership. We have consulting arm. We have a scale up arm, but we're the seventh largest global exec recruiting firm in the world. The journey there has been interesting just in the sense that, you know, 10 years ago, I raised private equity capital to grow. We were small at that point. We went from 10 million to 40 million the next 4 years with my first PE firm, and then brought in a second private equity sponsor about 5 years ago. And it's been hyper growth for us. I mean, we've gone from 40 million to 300 million. We bought 17 businesses. We've been really active in M&A, adding capabilities. And so that's been kind of the fun journey. The work we do, and I'd say I'm really proud of the work we do with clients, you know, and one of the things this year that's pretty unique about the firm, we have a sports recruiting business that works in all the professional sports. We do cool work. We just did the Atlanta Falcons head coach.
No way.
Yeah, we're working on the Vikings GM search. But in college athletics, we're actually the number one player. This year, we placed Kurt Cignetti in Indiana, who won the national championship. We placed Dusty May at Michigan in basketball, who won the national championship in basketball. So we placed two of the champions of the biggest sports with our clients. And so, you know, again, leadership matters. You look at kind of the lessons of, you know, Kurt Cignetti, who came from a small college to Indiana. Indiana was never a top 100 football program. I mean, an amazing transformation. And as a leader, he brought in a unique set of skills of certain profiles of players. And, you know, as a huge underdog, won a national championship. So, like, we're living in this moment in sports of, like, it couldn't be better with the successes we've had. But, you know, corporate side, we do fun work. Like, we've worked with, you know, major clients, Fortune 500 clients, you know, from OpenAI's, Microsoft's to Unilever's to, you know, big companies to private equity backed firms. We do a lot with private equity backed leadership, interesting entrepreneurs. Like, we just worked with one, Kendra Scott. You may know the name. She's a billionaire.
Yeah. Kind of my daughter gave me one of her necklaces for Christmas, my 12-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. We had the honor of working with Kendra on her CEO replacement. That was a fun project. So it's like, you know, working with interesting companies, trying to solve for, okay, you know, she was in a mode where she needed to bring in someone to succeed, a founder, and you have a dynamic founder who's built an amazing business. And, you know, so those are the kind of fun challenges we get doing board work, CEO work, building out organizations across sports, media, healthcare, life science, all these different sectors. So we get exposed to a lot of interesting firms, interesting business challenges. And I think that's what makes what we do quite fun and interesting.
Yeah, well, you have like a diversity of portfolio. Like, it's like what I'm hearing is like what you serve is really just getting great leaders in great spots. And yep. I feel like, you know, oftentimes in startup, people are like, well, you know, kind of pick a thing and go. And for us, like what we're solving for is cohesion, connection on teams, like getting alignment, you know, and it's like, it's sort of a universal problem. So we double down actually on VC, you know, kind of PE backed companies, hyper growth tech companies, because they are more vulnerable. But to your point, like it's a broad problem that can be solved, and it makes work interesting when you work with lots of different people. Yes. But the sports psych part is cool. Like, I mean, it's all cool, I think. But I saw a couple weeks ago the NFL. So I've done some stuff with professional sports teams, sort of like personally coaching, which has been awesome, working with athletes. And I just saw the other week that in sports psychology is like, when we look at culture, it's a metaphor people understand. So like when you talk about psychologists at work, people think therapy and they get scared and they're like, oh God, what is this? But when you say sports psychology, people understand optimization and performance and why teams really matter. And so we've been leaning into those metaphors a lot, sort of sports psychology for everyone. Everyone gets a sports psychologist and you measure kind of the alignment and the coaching and the insights all in one platform. But did you see recently that the NFL just mandated that all teams need sports psychologists now, a team psychologist on their team?
Yeah, I noticed that. And it's great. And in some ways, sports does lead business. I mean, I think now, and we have an executive coaching practice, and I think 10 years ago, executive coaching is not like it is today, where, you know, companies embrace it. And we'll talk about, I embrace it. I mean, I've got 6 or 7 of my leaders working with coaches, doing development, because there's only so much I'm going to do. I mean, I can help and push someone along in their development as a CEO, but, you know, I don't have time to really dig in, understand someone's history, their Hogan tendencies, or whatever tool we're using, right? To be able to then have a plan of development. So I think being intentional about development, and, you know, huge companies get that right, you know, the Fortune 500, but we work with, you know, in private equity, there's 30,000 private equity backed companies, amazing companies that in a lot of ways are now just realizing talent matters more than ever. You know, you can't just financially engineer your way to success. You have to really build good businesses, and that gets down to people. And, you know, you can't just keep firing people. You have to take and develop the team you have. And it plays into what you're saying of understanding understanding people and getting the most out of people, which in sports, you know, certainly, you know, I think the mindset of an athlete to make a clutch shot or hit an amazing golf shot when it matters, you get why that matters. But in business, you know, there's some parallels that I think now it's really becoming an awakening for leaders to say, we got to embrace some form of development.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we see that too. And even going like, you know, what we see sort of, I guess, one step further with that is really looking at the space in between. So I think historically, you know, there's been a lot of coaching around individuals or the leaders, but like we know, because we're hardwired for connection, social by nature, the space in between the individuals is really where optimization lives, because like the group or the team becomes a separate entity. And so things like the assessments that are out there, the individual ones like kind of fall short, you know, because it's like, how do you actually measure the team part of it or the space in between, which I find really exciting. That's what we've spent time operationalizing and kind of building out within this Harvard incubator, to measure like both through assessments, but then measuring behaviorally by looking at, you know, using a platform basically, which I think, especially in remote work where people feel so disconnected and that space in between so wide, it's becoming like more important. Like how do we, you know, optimize that part of the team or the organization?
Yeah. Well, and that leads into some stuff we're doing similar to what you're developing now, but we've developed a tech platform where when we do a search, we gather a lot of information on 3, 4, 5 CEO candidates, right? We've got scoring fields. We have a model of taking interview feedback, aggregating it into data. We have assessment tools we use. But the other thing we're adding now is we built an AI engine that looks at everything someone's ever said, podcasts, investor presentations, brings that in. And then we're synthesizing that within learning models to say, okay, from all the what we've learned about this executive, what could we draw as conclusions around culture fit? What could we draw as conclusions about EQ signals? And then leading to coaching and onboarding. So you get all this feedback, all this information. What do you do with it? Well, if you could then put it into, how would I best make this CEO successful quickly? How would I guide the company how to look at the nuance of this person? So I think we're in this era where data and information can be very useful to make a good hiring decision, but also development, onboarding, success, because, you know, like a third of our business is private equity backed business. It's a lot in that space. There's a short window to execute for leaders. Like you don't have 10 years. Like you better be making progress in the first 12 months, first six months. And so speed of onboarding, speed of impact is so important. And so we're embracing similar to what you're doing, just thinking about how do we bring more insight to, you know, on our side, decisioning, insight about the candidate's nuance, but then that'll help when the selection is made to make them successful. So it's fun stuff. I mean, I think there's really, really cool technologies emerging that I think will even enhance, you know, getting it right, which is
it's like coming back when we're first chatting, I feel like a lot of what you're doing is like getting people onboarded and matching, and we're actually just doing it on like the other side, you know, making sure this is like right, and then looking at the team versus you're looking at match between kind of leader and then organization and the team at that point. And we're looking at like space in between on the back end. But I think what you're hitting on, you're seeing the same thing we are, which is like, you know, AI has helped us look at behavioral indicators. There's so much data to be had, and AI allows us to synthesize that in a meaningful way. And in a lot of ways, upskill people, like coaching people using tech to understand the data, but also the kind of coaching part of it. And that is still so human. Like, nobody wants to sit with an AI coach. Like, sure, you can do a little bit in between to change behaviors, but we don't even know enough about the brain as is. Forget about trying to replicate it, you know, and like replicate the therapeutic process and, you know, the coaching. We know the relationship is the thing that is like most predictive of outcome within a coaching environment. That's not like, you know, you can't replicate that yet. But the behavioral stuff and the nudging and the feedback. So those two things together, like, truly are a model for, like, you know,
I agree. Marriage. It makes it more precise. It's a human touch. I mean, that's where we look at our business is very human and tech driven. Then together, you can do amazing things. And it does empower speed, insight, you know, efficiency. But at the same time, there is that element of the human, I would say, especially in terms of, you know, working with coaching or working with calendar, all that stuff. You've got to have a human element, but it gives you a better blueprint of things to focus on. So I think what might take 12 months, if you get a lot of success in 6 months, right? Or I think, or you just more impact in terms of what you're able to dig into.
Yeah, because operational speed is very much tied to all that, right? If there's like, if you're hedging or the relationship feels distant or like, this doesn't feel right, I'm not going to speak up, or I'm going to be like spending, you know, too long crafting an email or all the things. Whereas if you can get those things right, people move faster and more productively and more directly, which is, you know, drives outcomes. So anyway, we're down a rabbit hole that I was like, not here. I haven't even asked you any questions that I told you I was going to ask you. But that's how this goes. I gave you the heads up, right? So, so you know, you've really spent your career evaluating leaders and, you know, in leadership teams. And what are some of the things that you've seen that really separates high-performing executive teams and leaders from like ones that sort of maybe are a little sub-optimized or maybe quietly struggle or maybe loudly struggle? I don't know.
Yeah. And I'd say if we look at that through the lens of selection, you know, and I think you know, certainly every industry has different nuance of what makes a good leader, right? I mean, but I would say this, one of the things I would point to when you're evaluating a leader, now, I always look at, and I think this is one of the telling signs, is what kind of followership does that leader have, right? Mm-hmm. Is it the kind of leader that could come in and bring their chief marketing officer and their chief, you know, digital officer because they enjoyed working with that leader and they were successful before? You bring in a leader that has no followership, you know, there's probably something to be said about, you know, what happens, right? I mean, so I always look at that. If someone said, no, this leader has a continuity of people that follow them from organization to organization, there's certainly that, you know, cohesiveness of a team that follows, but they're just showing the leadership traits of relationship, I think, are standing out. And to me, that's, you know, I would center the answer on, you know, leadership is a lot about influence. It's a lot about followership and creating that. And so, you know, being able to say, does this leader have, you know, proven over time that people would run through a wall for them, right? I mean, the technical skills of a leader, you know, what they've done is one thing. But I think looking at followership is a pretty telling indicator of what I would call a leader that's going to quickly hit the ground running and have cultural success within an organization.
Yeah. Yeah. You're using like almost different words, but the same concept, which like for me, I'm like, okay, we're it's like connection or cohesion. It's the thing. So you think, I think about connection as like, you know, we chatted twice. You seem like a nice guy, you know, so threads of connection. But if I said something that annoyed you, you'd be like, screw Bobby, you know, whatever. But if we did this 10 times, we had 10 threads of connection, that would start to be cohesion. So you're going to have more grace with me. You're going to feel more connected to me. You're going to have, you know, bend with me a little bit more and allow us to ride out those bumps in a different way. And so like, you know, fast forward 10 years or 5 years in a team and you have that tether between you, it allows you just to operate at such a faster speed and then have a higher, like, you know, sort of wider berth of tolerance for things because you trust the person in a deeper way.
Yeah. You know? And I think it plays too. I mean, the question you can ask a leader, and we do this, is, you know, what do you think your first 30 days, your first 90 days would look like in this new role? And again, a lot of great leaders are going to listening tour. They will go, they will spend time with the team before they come out. And they may have in their mind like, hey, I'm coming in to turn this around or to accelerate this organization, right? There's something that bringing a new leader in to do. And the board has interviewed them in this, or the private equity firm, and they've got a grand plan to make change. Well, if you come in and you don't get the buy-in of the team, it creates, you know, pushback, it creates, you know, resistance. And so, you know, smart leaders, you know, have a, you know, it takes time, but say, listen, first 30 days, 60 days, I'm going out to the factories. I am going to understand how things work. I'm going to listen. I'm going to hear input, because they probably got 80% of the story right through interviewing, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're being sold into an organization. Sometimes there's underlying challenges, but yeah, a good leader. So I think some of those signs of like, you know, how, I mean, it's EQ. I mean, it's emotional intelligence. It's saying, do you have empathy? Are you going to be able to understand really what's going on to be able to drive the change that you need? That to me is kind of what a listening tour would do, is like being able to say, okay, I get the objective. I get the resistance. I understand what's happened. Now I can figure out the path forward to, you know, to kind of implement the agenda that I'm going to implement anyway, but you know, I need to do it in a thoughtful way. And I think we see leaders who come in who don't do that. It's a disaster. You know, it is resistance. It is, you know, it's hard work. And so I think that piece, you know, it to me is pretty telling, depending on the situation, you know, in terms of what they're stepping into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the classes I want you to come through is motivation. And what we teach, it's really like teaching coaching framework to business leaders, right? And so we teach motivational interviewing. And the first step's relationship building. You can't make any change or you're going until you actually have like built rapport. And I feel like what you're describing is doing that at scale. Really in the service, the psychobabble term we use is minimizing reactance. Like if I come in, I'm like, I'm going to change your system. You're going to push back and say, no, you're not. You know what I mean? So like that same thing happens in one-on-one dynamics. It happens in teams. It happens. But then if you're a senior leader and you're going in, the same model like sort of works because humans are humans, right? We don't want to be told what to do. We want to feel seen and heard. We want to feel like, you know, we're part of the story and that this history that we build is, you know, carrying forward and need a leader that's going to signal that that matters, like through listening, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was talking to a chief people officer of a, you know, like really large enterprise like recently. And they had a new CEO who was like young. And I think she was excited about them generally, a lot of good ideas, but he was kind of like, I'm going to come in and I'm going to like go on a tour of the, you know, the United States and tell everyone my vision and all this stuff. And she was like, no, like show up and ask questions. Do not do that. Nobody cares about your vision. You know, like you want to have some structure to like say this, what I'm thinking, what do you think? By using, you know, opportunity to kind of neutralize power, invite people in, do all the things so people build trust with you, you know? And I think because the person was particularly young, there was probably a little bit of a, you know, mild insecurity, potentially or large, I don't know. I don't know this person, like around needing to come in as a strong leader, you know? And it was actually was totally about to like work against him. But a really savvy chief people officer was like helping kind of coach around that.
So common what you're describing, and it rarely works out well when somebody comes in with all the ideas and, you know, doesn't listen. And everybody's just like, you haven't been here for 10 years living with what I've lived with. Now you're stepping in with these, you know, grand ideas. So I think there is that whole element of just connecting to people that great leaders do, right? And you can get people, and again, I always say leadership is just really influencing people. And so people, you have to understand them, and you don't have to agree with it necessarily. You need to understand their view and to be able to guide them towards, you know, your vision in a way that they get it and understand it, and they will follow you. Because, you know, again, titles don't require people to follow you. I mean, leadership is earning that followership, and I think that for, you know, great leaders, they understand that and they embrace that. And for those who think the title gives them the right to do what they do, they tend to be the ones that we're replacing, you know, the ones that drive work for us when we've got a problem. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a relational thing, right? We can use all these different sort of labels, but I love earning the followership. That's like a great kind of like phrase. And but it's really building a strong relationship with people at scale, you know, like how do you do that at scale by, you know, but all the kind of principles of building a strong relationship. I just went, you know, I function more like an organizational psychologist, but I'm actually a clinical psychologist. So, you know, I look through the lens in which I see the world is sort of relational dynamic. Anyway, I was just down in New York last weekend. Do you know Esther Perel? Have you ever heard of her?
Yeah.
She's incredible. She's this couples therapist, relational expert. But like, if you looked her up, you'd be like, what is this? How does this have to do? You know, there's a bunch of like sex therapist people there, relationship experts, couples people. But the principles, like, again, using different labels, because they're talking about couples therapy stuff mainly or family therapy stuff. But I'm like, it's the same principles. We just have to kind of relabel and make not weird for work. But it's like a relational thing because we're relational beings. Yeah. You know what I mean?
100%. And that's, again, we go back to the big question of what AI is going to not replace is leadership, right? I mean, so, you know, so there's still leaders, the people, and they drive outcomes. And, you know, so I think it's, you know, the work that you do and the work that we do is going to continue to be important. I think it'll never stop. People are people. And, you know, it's always going to be challenges with personalities and what comes to the table with their histories.
Yeah, that's just, these are foundational human needs, right? Like, and those are not going away, no matter how much AI we're like adopting.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of what I was going to ask you about, we've like sort of talked about, but it's like, you've scaled a lot of businesses through periods of like intense growth, right? You've done hard things with these two companies and you work with a lot of companies going through this.
Yeah.
How do leaders like maintain culture and cohesion and this relational strength, or earning that followership, to use your words, through these different periods while moving fast? The biggest pushback we get with people, especially new to this work, is like, oh God, this takes time. I get it, but I'm not going to sit down with all my people and have these long coaching conversations, So how do you move fast and build relationship? And also, Are there other things that you've seen that like work in challenging times for companies?
Yeah. I mean, you've kind of defined it. I mean, it's relationships at scale. Like when you're smaller, I had a management team, 50 people, I had 5 leaders and I had 15 billers, and I could spend time with the biller group. I could spend time with my leaders, a lot of one-on-one time. And then as you grow, the demands of a leader change, and everybody still wants the time of a CEO. So in an entrepreneurial business, it's especially acute, like the change from, I'm used to working directly with the CEO, to now you've got me with a second line leader. And so, we've just thought about it where, I have a C-suite, which, there's 8 leaders in my C-suite. Then we have subgroups that I'll spend time with. So if I'm in Austin, Texas, I'm at lunch with my 18 people in Texas. If I'm in Chicago, I'm having a coffee and a meet with the 20 people there. So that becomes like intentional drop-in stuff. We do annual summits with, all of our 250 top leaders for 3 days with, relationship fund, So it's like we have a scheduled cadence to what we do. I mean, even today, we have principals and associates who are aspiring to work with clients, but they do the hard work. I just did a training session with 35 of them for an hour on how they develop their career. Now, I'll do that 2 or 3 times a year, so they get some FaceTime with me and some relationship time with me. So I think it's, to your point, it's relationship at scale, and then trying to impart upon, your leaders the style. I've got leaders. I want to emulate my style 60-70%, but I want them to have their own nuance to who they are. Like the firm is going to be somewhat in the culture of how I am as a CEO, but I also want them to bring their own flair, their own nuance and strength to it. So it's pouring into them and reinforcing in them the same kind of things that are important to me. And I've always been in a business where it's a people business. Business services is all about people. So, we've had to be very thoughtful about relationship building, creating loyalty with teams. People work for people, not for companies. I mean, I remind my people all the time, we have a nice company and a nice brand, but they work for people, and they will lead because they're a leader, not because of a company. So you have to develop what I would develop with you, with them, create that same kind of, there's that element of intimacy that you have to have, which, in some big organizations gets lost because it's just a job and a number. And, but I think in a scaling organization that's a challenger brand, that's like a ZRG or, in that middle market, the relationships matter a whole lot more than if you're a Dow 30 Google kind of company or something, right?
Yeah, because that's the driver versus like you're relying on the brand at like scale that's already, But yeah, no, I think that's a great point too, is like relationships matter both internally and externally. So it's like the same skill that we're talking about, you're using to hire in, that we're using sort of within the teams, also matter externally in terms of how you treat your partners. And I had one of our advisors we're part of this, this incubator at Harvard at the Institute of Quantitative Social Science in the Startup Foundry, have a fantastic advisor there. And he's like, Bobby, never be a vendor. You're not a vendor ever. That's not how you see the world. And it's like, if you get in this like vendor thing and you're negotiating price, it's just not where you want to be. And it's not going to, don't do that, or you can say that's like, we could do that, but is that really what you want to? And just get on the same page around solving a problem together and figuring out how to price whatever you're doing. Yeah. And it's just so much better, I think, in terms of both building a relationship, but also like really truly being invested to work collaboratively to solve a problem, which then is going to lead to like longer business and better relationships like across the board.
I'll say this to clients, and I encourage my team to think this way. We don't want a transaction. We want a relationship. And sometimes clients will come to us with a single need, and they'll say, tell us all about you, why you should solve this one problem we have. And it's like, no, we're not, that's fine. We'll do, but we want to talk about how we help you as an organization over time with the broad range of talent problems that we have. We want a relationship that transcends the transaction. And so, you know, one thing is not going to define us. Let's talk about how we can be partners. And I think it's that mentality of business partners versus transactional thinking, I think, mm-hmm. is important. Clients want partners. You don't need vendors.
Yeah.
I think and it elevates, you know, your ability to really solve a client's problems, which we take very seriously. We monitor that in a high way. I mean, I think our top 10 clients, we averaged like 13 engagements with them last year, which is a lot of work across an organization. You know, so we kind of look at that. How do we broadly support a client? It's a failure if you have one single transaction. We need to look at how we support a client in a bigger way, providing value that keeps expanding.
Mm-hmm. How do you think about, this is more of like a question I'm asking selfishly, but how do you think about like scalability and staying within your lane versus like just sort of flexing to meet the needs? But or maybe that's just part of your business model. Like, so for us, we're trying to like scale or that I was like wondering for you, is that just kind of like you become a partner and then flex?
No, I think, you know, in our world, like a lot of worlds, high specialization matters, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you heard me say we're in a bunch of sectors, but I had bought expertise, like we bought a sports recruiting business that is highly specialized in sports. And now we quadruple the size of it under our stewardship. It is the leading player in sports recruiting in North America.
Yeah.
It is a specialist solution provider in sports, part of a bigger brand network. So like when we're in a niche, like we're trying to develop, you know, niche boutique expertise in our life science practice or healthcare practice. These are like an example in my healthcare practice, I've got medical doctors who execute work. I've got pharmacy CEOs now that execute the work. Like they can speak to the challenges of that industry in a very highly specialized way, right? But we can deliver it at scale. So I think for us, it's that best. We started the firm. I said to him, I started it where I was going after financial service clients, very niche. What I knew, I stayed in my lane. Like to that point, like I didn't get out of my lane.
Yeah.
I knew where I had expertise. If someone said, could you help me in life sciences? I'd say, no, I know financial services. I know how to build a lending business. I will help you there. So I think, you know, we're broad now, but we're broad with expertise. And I think you know, for business to stay super focused in what you do, you may find adjacencies that you can build on. But, you know, I think we're in a world where a generalist almost in any sense is not going to succeed. You have to find your lane. Expertise that, you know, sets you apart.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's more of a reflection of your like stage in development, right? It's like you're there. So you have all these people that you've like stitched together to build this like really kind of powerful company, but that's not what you did like straight out of the gate, you know?
No, and that's where M&A has come in for us. It's been fun. I mean, we've done 17 acquisitions. I've been able to build sectors, build regions. You know, we've expanded our footprint to the Middle East, to Singapore, to Brazil, Mexico, Peru. So, you know, and then we've added industry expertise. You know, we added a media practice, a sports practice. We added a supply chain practice. Sometimes, you know, and we looked at it from we can hire, we can acquire, we can lift out teams. So we've got kind of a multi-pronged growth strategy, which makes it kind of fun. So we're like all hands on deck for growth, but we're open to the channel by which we do that. And you work in the higher ed sector at Harvard. Like you know, we have actually a pretty significant higher ed practice. We have the biggest interim business in higher ed called The Registry. We have the biggest college recruiting business we bought called Turnkey. We do college leadership work. We do college facility work. I bought a business that does real estate recruiting for facility managers across universities. Has worked with 200 universities doing facility work. So like we now have a $60-70 million higher ed practice, but it's made up of all these specialty areas that are now part of ZRG. The vision is $100 million higher ed sector made up of all the areas that an institution would need in talent. So it's kind of fun to build out expertise by sector, right? Through hiring, acquiring, and doing it. I mean, that's the fun part of my job today is kind of architecting expertise at scale and then competing with, you know, the bigger players we compete with.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can see your like passion in this. Like, I'm thinking like this core, you know, we all want to keep learning and growing. Like humans are like most humans want to like learn and grow. And I definitely feel that. Like, I love being in startup because I just keep learning new stuff and talking to cool people. But I can like see that in you. You're like learning these like verticals and then going into the crevices of them and being like, what do we need? How do we build it? Who do we pull together? and then just keeping doing that, which is like expanding your footprint like all over the place.
Yeah, no, I think as you see, I mean, I spend my time on growth, innovation, and like key people. Like if I look at like where I split my time as a CEO, I love growing things. The innovation side, I enjoy, got a good team there. And then thinking about, the people development side, you know, in the early days of growth, I spent half my time recruiting. When we were in that scale up phase, it was all about bringing talent in. And now I've built a talent attraction engine for my key billers, but I still spend now time passing on to my key leaders what they should be. So, you know, I think that the joy of it as an entrepreneur is just that the challenge evolves to a different challenge, you know, each couple of years. Like today, my challenge is a lot different than 5 years ago, from 10 years ago. So it doesn't feel like the same. Even though I've been doing this 20 years, the challenge gets to be a different one. And you know, eventually I'll probably, you know, need to find someone who can run a $1 billion business that's not me. But, you know, I enjoy it at this point. I've got it to where we are. I get it to a certain point, and then there'll be another leader that probably is at scale, better at doing certain things that I'm not good at, and you know, look forward to that day. You
know. Will you recruit your own person?
Well, developing, we've got people we're developing, and yeah, we do. We, as we say, we buy our own fried ice cream, and yeah, we do our little recruiting and believe in our process for sure.
Yeah,
I also believe in, you know, finding the opportunity internally for people to develop, and so, you know, trying to pour into. And into my team, you know, the ability to step up and grow and do that is important. So,
Well, that's fun. I mean, I feel like I could just keep chatting with you, Larry, but where, you know, I was like, oh, we got to end like before 30, we're 10 minutes over. So sorry, Finn, but Finn's our podcast guy. Who's good. I was like, Bobby, but what if I didn't ask you that anything I didn't ask you that you want to share or any take home tips?
Yeah, no, just, I mean, I think I'd certainly like to share. I mean, I wrote a book, The Seven Pillars of Growth Leadership. It's kind of my journey, but it's kind of seven pillars of growth that have, I think, influenced my journey around building entrepreneurial businesses. So I think if someone's interested in, in scaling the business, there's some great learnings there. I think particularly for me, just in from zero to a couple hundred million twice, there's some things I've certainly shared in that book. So it's Seven Pillars of Inspired Leadership. You can find it on free on Spotify. You can buy it on Amazon or iBooks, but certainly enjoy sharing my journey to see other entrepreneurs succeed. I'm passionate about, you know, we live in a great country where, you know, you can start a business with an idea and it turns into something, and love to see entrepreneurs who share, you know, kind of that passion to create.
Well, I can't wait to read that. I don't know how I haven't read that yet, but I'm absolutely going to read that. And we'll put that in the show notes too, which will be good. But I just appreciate you coming, Larry. That's really fun. And just congrats on all the success. Like, you're such a great model of doing, you know, just building businesses and doing it in different ways. And just like, you still have that like passion for it, you know, which is just awesome. So thanks for like sharing your time with me.
No, it's a pleasure to chat, and I appreciate the work you're doing as well. And, let's keep the conversation going.
Yeah, of course.